You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine conflict, Middle East war. What we're looking at now is a two-front problem. And I begin in Ukraine because the headlines there speak to the European support for the efforts in eastern Ukraine, where there is no significant movement of the forces, but there's a great deal of anxiety about the third winter of war and 2024. Olaf Scholz, the Chancellor of Germany, has denounced Vladimir Putin's cynical concern, word cynical in quotes, over the fate of civilians in the Israel-Hamas conflict as the Russian army wages war in Ukraine. Mr. Scholz said, "It makes me more than furious to hear the Russian president repeatedly warning that there could be civilian casualties from an armed conflict. It doesn't get more cynical than that." At the same time, Mr. Scholz said that the EU, which Germany dominates with its economy, must continue to back Ukraine financially. There are other headlines that speak to Ukraine as well. For example, there's a journalist, a Radio Free Europe journalist, now detained in Russia for spying. This is a matter that will be taken up by journalism everywhere, but clearly it is not easy to be in Russia, to be a correspondent from outside. And this it may indicate a new dragnet for journalists. Also, Mr. Lavrov, the foreign minister, has been in Pyongyang recently, and Russia is now expressing that its relationship with North Korea, a failed state where people are, well, anyway, very troubled. A new strategic level of cooperation with North Korea. I welcome Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft to comment on where the war is now from the point of view of the EU. Mr. Scholz speaking out, suggesting there may or may not be new concerns about the third winter of war. Anatole, I very much enjoyed your conversation with Professor Peter Robinson recently, and we're going to discuss his new book, Russian Liberalism. But before we get to the future for Russia, it's the present that is most pressing. In your measure right now, is Russia as exhausted as Ukraine, or is it finding new strength in this second front breaking out and distracting, detaining, overwhelming the United States? I'm talking about the Middle East. Good evening to you.
Hello, John. Well, I mean, undoubtedly, in the short term, what's happening in the Middle East is, of course, tremendously beneficial to Russia. But so far, Russia has not gone nearly as far as it could in the Middle East against America. And I think that's above all for two reasons, or three. The first is that the Putin regime has always had very good relations with Israel and with the Netanyahu government in particular. That's related to the second reason, which is that Russia remains extremely concerned about the threat of Islamist terrorism. And you have to remember that many of the ISIS recruits, both in Syria and in Afghanistan, were Muslims from Russia or Central Asia. Actually, the latest terrorist attack in France was carried out by a Chechen refugee. And obviously Russia fears that if there is a general meltdown in the Middle East, that could greatly increase that threat to Russia. And the third reason, perhaps, is that Russia is acutely aware of the threat of a US-Israeli attack on Iran, something that hardliners in America are and Israel are assiduously working for. Now, on the one hand, that would be a tremendous gift to Russia, because it would tie down the United States. It would create the impression of complete moral equivalence between America and Russia in the eyes of most of the world. But on the other hand, Iran has become a major supplier of arms, particularly drones, to Russia for the Ukraine war. And of course, if Iran were attacked by America and Israel, then that would cease. So Russia is still, I think, pursuing a quite cautious line there. But as we see from the growing closeness between Russia and North Korea, the longer this war goes on, the more people across the world are liable to be sucked in on one side or the other. And obviously, Russia is going to look for assistance wherever it can get it.
I want to press the matter.
By the way, North Korea is, of course, as you say, a disastrous state, but it has an awful lot of ammunition.
I want to press the matter of what Russia is today, right now, and I learned a great deal from your conversation with Peter Robinson earlier this week, and I recommend it to everyone on the Quincy Institute site. You can go and listen in and watch the exchange between Anatole and the professor. The new book that he has, and I've read the chapter on Putin and Russian liberalism, is entitled Russian Liberalism, which right now is under severe assault in Russia. One way of putting it was Alexander Tsipras. I very much appreciated the irony. He argues that those who value Russian tradition don't value freedom, and those who value freedom don't value Russian tradition. Now, that's meant to be witty in a Russian fashion. But I learned from Professor Robinson, his book, that during the Crimea annexation of 2014, it was a surprise, a shock, a challenge to Russian liberals. These are people who follow either Nemtsov, who was murdered in Moscow, or Navalny, who is jailed and abused by the Russian state now as liberals, that the Russian liberals in 2014 were shocked and felt that they'd wandered into mental derangement by their co-patriots, because there was cheering and support for Putin's annexation. That means that today the Russian liberals are much beleaguered, and I'm guessing they keep to themselves. Are they at risk for more abuse than just keeping their comments quiet in public settings? Do they face roundups or brutality or losing jobs, anything like that, Anatole?
Not if they keep quiet, I think. The people who've been targeted in Russia are those who have spoken out against the war. There are many, many more who deeply disapprove of the war, but who simply, you know, as in so many countries, it must be said, keep their opinions to themselves. So, you know, this is not yet anything resembling a Stalinist terror, though undoubtedly it's become a great deal more authoritarian since the war. But the isolation of liberals is greater than you would suggest, because, in fact, Navalny has never condemned the annexation of Ukraine as of Crimea as such. All he has said is that this must be, you know, ratified by a genuine, you know, and legitimate popular referendum. But in the point is that, you know, Russians regard Crimea the way that people in the south of Ireland used to regard Northern Ireland, or Pakistanis regard Kashmir, or Indians regard Kashmir. In other words, this is simply a historic part of Russian territory. It's not an issue for most Russians, because, of course, you know, Russia had Crimea until it was transferred to Ukraine by the Soviet Union in 1954. So, I mean, what this illustrates is that the Russian liberals, I mean, partly because of Putin's policies, but partly because in the 1990s and after, they identified so completely with the West and Western policies, that at a time when, of course, the West was adopting a more and more hostile attitude to Russia. That is not a recipe for popularity in almost any country.
Another revelation in your conversation with Mr. Robinson, it's not in the chapter I read, chapter 11, but it was in your exchange. Mistakes made. And the formula, as I understand it, is there was not appreciation by Russian liberals and their friends around the world that the nationalization or the denationalization and the privatization of major industries, oil and the natural resources, was not going to go correct, was not going to be correct because there were no courts, that there was just open theft and it upset everyone and introduced a kind of an anarchy into Russia that they're living with ever since. So that they're in fact two states. There's a constitutional state and there's a regime and they're parallel. And that was the answer to the theft that we saw in the 1990s. Do I have that correct? The theft became the predicate for the regime to take power and be authoritarian.
Yeah, absolutely. I lived in Russia and Ukraine in the 90s, and there was simply an orgy of theft and corruption, contributing to a collapse of the economy, declined by around 40%, and a shattering fall in living standards and rise in mortality, in early mortality. But I think, in all honesty, I have to say something here. There were two legal regimes in London as well and in New York. There was one legal regime which enforced the law as far as ordinary people were concerned, and there was another regime for Western banks under the Labour, it must be said, in Britain, heading of light touch regulation. They were allowed to transfer this stolen money from Russia and Ukraine, as previously, of course, they had from Pakistan and Nigeria and Angola and other places, to Western banks, investments, real estate, luxury property, tax havens in the Caribbean. So the point is that the Russian people saw the West as deeply complicit in this corruption and theft, while at the same time insistently lecturing Russia on its bad behavior. I mean, inevitably, I mean, that combination is going to cause a backlash.
And the backlash was boosted by the perception that NATO was marching closer and closer to Moscow. I'm looking for what it is that made Vladimir Putin necessary. Not inevitable, but necessary. He was going to win the war in Chechnya. He was going to clean up the corruption, the theft of natural resources, the pearls, I think they were called at the time, the pearls of Russia. And he was going to stop the West march on Moscow. He was going to protect the frontiers. That was early Putin. Is that late Putin? Is he still popular because of that formula?
Well, I always remember a conversation I had with a small businesswoman in Moscow who ran a small chain of cafes. And I asked her about her attitude to Putin. And she said, look, you know, we don't like the high level corruption and the domination by these state oligarchs, these cronies of Putin. But she said, you know, in the 1990s, the power of the mafia was such that it made the lives of small businessmen almost impossible, or at least extremely dangerous. You never knew when a new mafia group was going to come and demand money. They were competing with each other. And if you didn't pay, they would burn down your business and possibly kill you. And she said that, you know, bad as things are in Russia, Putin restored order, basic order, after that nightmare of the 1990s. And for that, she said, despite all our problems with him, we are still grateful to him for that. She said, people like her. But secondly, she said, we are, of course, afraid that if Putin falls, if he's overthrown, we could return to those days. In other words, you know, we have no confidence in anybody's ability to replace Putin as an effective government.
Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, his conversation with Peter Robinson. The book is Russian Liberalism. We turn to Europe right now and its continuing or not support of Ukraine. I'm John Batchelor.
You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.